Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, continuing my conversation with author Larry Tye about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Tye is a former Boston Globe reporter. He's written many books, been on the show a number of times. Some of those books include Superman and a book about Satchel Paige. And I should say that Larry Tye is an old friend and formerly a colleague in a journalism fellowship program. Okay, so, you know, you got to speak to all kinds of people like Ethel Kennedy who'd never told the true stories before. You got into documents you were talking about that hadn't ever been shared before. How did the Kennedy family, the myth-making machinery, react? How have they reacted to this book when you've been busy telling stories that maybe they didn't want told?
So that's a great question, and the answer is I can't give you a factual and truthful answer. I hear secondhand that they liked it, but I know that some people in the family who were among the bigger sort of buy into everything that Bobby did as being righteous won't like parts of it, won't like the McCarthy part of it, won't like the Cuban Missile Crisis that we were just talking about. I think that others, including, I think at least, but I don't know for sure, Ethel, who I have not seen since the book came out, I suspect that what she cares about, she was the one who helped me puncture some of those myths. She was the one who told me Joe McCarthy may have been a monster to the rest of America, but to us, he was the guy who came over and was totally smitten by our toddler, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. She was so honest that the honesty in the book, you know, is partly due to her. This weekend, one of the Shriver kids, the Kennedy cousins, Eunice Shriver was Bobby and Jack's sister, one of the Shriver kids tweeted out to friends, buy this book. It's, you know, this is what you have to be reading this weekend. Different people have signaled along the way that they like the version. Everywhere I go on speaking, and I've probably done 25 talks so far, somebody shows up in the audience who was a Bobby staffer or a Bobby confidant of somewhere and says, you know, we love the way he was more of a flesh and blood hero at the end of the book than he was at the beginning. And that's the way he was to me, that if somebody is sort of too saintly to be believed, you don't believe them. If somebody looks like they have lead feet and they have flaws, and yet in the end they learn from them, then in the end they become a more convincing hero. And he started out as my hero, he ended up as my hero, and I think that I judged the early Bobby Kennedy by the standards of the later Bobby Kennedy.
Interesting.
Somebody else who helped me bust myths was, again, this guy, Anthony Lewis. And your father saw Bobby Kennedy in his crude sort of beginning of the learning curve phase when he first got to the Justice Department. And some of the stories in my book that are the least complimentary about him came from your father. The stories that were also the most complimentary about him came from your father because he saw the growth. And David, today, if I told you a politician transformed, you might come back with the word of the moment, which is, then was he a flip-flopper? And Bobby Kennedy showed that politicians could grow without being without just going with where the political winds were blowing. He, in fact, was changing half the time before the country was ready for his change. And his change made me believe that politicians can actually do good things.
What was it about Bobby Kennedy that drew such interesting people to him? I'm thinking of, there are a lot of people who work for Bobby who have held him up, you know, in the highest regard for their whole lives, who never worked in politics again. I'm thinking of people like John Siegenthaler, the longtime newspaper publisher who worked for him in the Justice Department and had this extraordinary role in the civil rights movement, or even Jeff Greenfield, the political commentator, who the one politician he ever worked for was in that 68 campaign. What was it about Bobby Kennedy that drew people that never engaged in politics the same way again?
So it's a great question, and that's half of what drew me to write this book, that people who were my mentors and your mentors, like John Siegenthaler, like the old New York Times Washington bureau chief Bill Kovich, who never fell in love with a politician other than Bobby Kennedy, and who never took time off from journalism other than the 3 months he took off to work for Bobby Kennedy's campaign in California in 1968, I wanted to understand what drew them to him. And I will answer that question by telling you about one specific journalist who, again, some of your listeners might know, at least his son. And it's a guy named Richard Harwood. Son is John Harwood of CNBC. Richard Harwood was a reporter in 1968 for the Washington Post. He was an ex-Marine who had helped in the Battle of Iwo Jima, had come away with scars. He was as tough a guy as you could ever find, and that's why Bill Bradley named him to cover Bobby Kennedy in 1968. He thought, this is the one guy who can never be compromised. Harwood starts out playing touch football with Bobby early, like everybody on the campaign trail did with him. He came away with a bloody nose and convinced that Bobby played dirty in football as well as in politics, so he was even less inclined to ever give this guy the benefit of the doubt. He thought that the word that most characterized Bobby, the word ruthless, was also accurate. By the end of the campaign, Harwood had spent so many sessions watching Bobby tell precisely the same story in the black community as he did in the white community. He told both of them, we need safe streets, and the only way we're going to get safe streets is by having racial justice. He was the opposite of a demagogue by telling audiences precisely what they did not want to hear. And by the end, Harwood had so fallen in love with Bobby Kennedy that he went to Ben Bradley and he said, would you take me off the campaign? I'm in love with a candidate. I can't cover him objectively anymore. And Bradley said no. Bradley, who had fallen in love with Jack Kennedy 10 years before, said, no, you got to stick it out. And the most eloquent of all the eulogies written after Bobby was assassinated was by Richard Harwood.
In the book, you write about some of Bobby's sort of epic battles with such figures as Roy Cohn, whose name is being brought up in the context of being a mentor to Donald Trump, Jimmy Hoffa, LBJ, Castro, and others. Talk about that sort of the pugilistic Bobby Kennedy.
So Bobby Kennedy always knew very clearly who his enemies were, and he would never, once he had decided somebody was an enemy, he very seldom changed opinions about that person. And his enemies included the people that you have been talking about. His first ultimate enemy was Roy Cohn, who was his boss when he worked for Jimmy Hoffa. And Bobby thought that Roy Cohn was a little arrogant, I'm not sure what words I can use on your FCC-regulated radio, but he didn't like him. And he blamed Senator McCarthy's excesses on his aide, Roy Cohn. And the truth was that Cohn felt the same way about Bobby. He thought he was spoiled, which he was. He thought that he got the job because of his father, Joe Kennedy, giving money to Joe McCarthy, which he did. And he thought that Bobby was not a great lawyer, which he wasn't at that point. So they despised one another, and that turned into a vendetta. It turned into a vendetta where Bobby, as Attorney General, kept bringing cases against Roy Cohn. And my only regret is that he hadn't convicted him and sent him to jail so that he couldn't turn around years later and become a mentor to Donald Trump. But Bobby generally had a pretty clear sense of who were the white hats and who were the black hats. Jimmy Hoffa was another black hat in his mind. He was a guy who had corrupted the Teamsters, according to Bobby Kennedy. And the fact that he couldn't bring him down when Bobby was an aide to the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations, the famous Rackets Committee, the old McCarthy Committee that had become the Rackets Committee, and that he couldn't convict him until a jury tampering charge, which was sort of a secondary charge when Bobby was Attorney General, that didn't make him any less convinced that Jimmy Hoffa was guilty of everything that he charged. What he couldn't see with Roy Cohn and what he couldn't see with Jimmy Hoffa, and it proved true with his enemies later in life, was that these people had two sides to them. It was Jimmy Hoffa's tenacity that had made the Teamsters the biggest and most powerful union in America, and that had helped 1.3 million truck drivers earn a better living. Jimmy Hoffa was a hero to them for a reason. Roy Cohn, in fact, was brilliant. And, in fact, all the things that he did wrong for McCarthy, I blame on McCarthy, who was his boss, not on Roy Cohn. And I think all of these people had two sides. Bobby, in the way that he viewed the world then, it was a world without much nuance. It was a world of white hats and black hats. Bobby was the good guy, and his enemies, Roy Cohn, Jimmy Hoffa, J. Edgar Hoover, and later, most tragically of all, Lyndon Johnson, those were the bad guys.
In conclusion, Larry, talk about the making of a liberal icon. Talk about the liberal icon, who he became, the man who ran that epic campaign, the man who went to South Africa and made the Ripple of Hope speech. Talk about who he became and what was lost when he died.
Great. If I could do that by telling you a very quick story, and the story is a story very relevant to today. The story is in April 1968, Bobby Kennedy is contesting his first primary, and it's in Indiana, and his plane lands in Indianapolis, and he's told that Martin Luther King has been shot and killed. The then mayor of Indianapolis, a guy named Richard Lugar, who went on to become a powerful senator, tells Bobby, "You will not go into the rally you plan to go to tonight in the black community." Bobby says, "Interesting, here I go." He goes into the black community, he jumps up on the back of a flatbed truck, and for the next 5 minutes, he gives the most pitch-perfect speech that a white politician may have ever given to a black audience in America, telling that audience that he feels their suffering having lost Martin King, and for the first time talking about what it felt like to him losing his brother. By the end of those 5 minutes, an audience that he had gone in to embrace was embracing him. It felt so badly. He managed to create a situation where in 100 U.S. cities that night, there was race rioting. Part of Washington, D.C. was burned down that night. The only American city with a sizable African-American population that didn't riot that night was Indianapolis, and that was because of Bobby Kennedy. For the rest of his life, without hyperbole, I can say he was the singly most popular white man in black America. For the rest of his life, he was greeted by signs in the ghetto that read, "White, but all right." And for the rest of his life, he was precisely the tough liberal, or if you prefer, the tender conservative, that I think most of us 50 years later are still waiting for.
Well, Larry Tye has been my guest. His new book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry, thank you so much, and we'll keep waiting.
Great. Thank you, David.